What kind of risk factors can lead to adverse effects in meditation? How to tell the difference between a healthy and dysfunctional meditation group? What is a snakeskin principle? And what is a person-centered approach to meditation? My name is Ari-Pekka Skarp, and this is the Laboratory of Mind podcast. So, welcome to the Laboratory of Mind podcast. My guest today is Dr. Willoughby Britton, who is a licensed clinical psychologist and a researcher specializing in the research of effects of meditation, especially these adverse effects that we might have. Welcome, Willoughby.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's very nice to have you in this podcast. I just mentioned to you briefly that I've reviewed some of your research findings and also used those in my latest book on mindfulness and compassion. So, first of all, could you say something about how you became interested in the meditation? What's your own background in meditation practice?
So, my origin story?
Okay, yeah.
My origin story is like a lot of people's, in that I had kind of a life crisis that propelled me into needing help. And a friend, when I was in college, an old friend from childhood committed suicide. And so I was devastated and really discombobulated and really had never had anything like that happen to me before. And I really didn't want to take medication at that stage. I was only 20. And so my dad gave me the book A Path with Heart by Jack Kornfield. And that was my gateway drug. And I started, you know, reading that and carrying it around with me everywhere, and it really became my kind of Bible for maybe even as long as a decade after that. So that was how I started. That's kind of the short story.
Yeah. So you said that you had that book and practice for a decade. So how did you find the practice? Did it help you with your things and goals?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the first half of the book is just a kind of basics around navigating the mind. And I think that for any beginner meditator who's never really spent a lot of time watching their minds, there's a lot to learn and a lot to know about how your mind works and how to work with it. So that piece is, you know, I think essential for, I don't know, it should be basic training for anybody. Should be able to know how to, you know, what are thoughts, how do they work, how are they linked with emotions, how does that interact with body sensations, what are my own patterns, what are my signals that I'm kind of getting a little bit too activated or too underactivated, like, you know, how does that look for me, just spending a little bit more time, like, you know, getting to know myself, really. Yeah.
So were you also involved in some meditation groups, or did you do it just by yourself?
I think that at the beginning I read a lot of books. I mean, I think in general books have been kind of, I mean, here's my, you know, those are like my, I'm showing him a picture of all my books. Yeah, books are kind of they're like friends, you know, I mean, they're like people that are inside those books talking to you. So books have always been a big thing, but you know, I started listening, and this is before podcasts and like were a thing, right? So I started listening to like cassette tapes. Remember those cassette tapes?
Yeah.
Cassette tapes with like Pema Chodron and that kind of thing. So you know, yeah, I did a lot of kind of independent study, but I did go on retreats with different teachers. I was a member of a sangha in Tucson, which is where I went to graduate school, and that the main teacher of that particular sangha was Shinzen Young. So you know, loosely, and I did a lot of training in like Theravada kind of oriented, Theravada Western insight practice. But I wasn't like, you know, monogamous. I had I played around with Tibetan Buddhism and other teachers that would come through.
Yeah. So were your practices mainly like a sitting meditation or also this kind of a bodily practices like yoga or qigong or something like that?
What was my practice?
Yeah. So did you have also like a bodied practices or mainly sitting meditation?
I mean, I started practicing like more than 25 years ago. So, you know, I've done a little bit of everything and I've gone through phases of different things. So, I mean, I'll also mention that in graduate school, I trained to become an MBSR instructor. And then I also trained to become a mindfulness-based cognitive therapy instructor. So those also kind of became my kind of lineage in my sangha in some way, even though I was also practicing some of the other in other traditions. So that was also a, you know, a group or a meditation kind of tradition. So which was very informative to how I was practicing. So they do a lot of focus on breath awareness. So I would say that was probably my main practice for the first like 10 years, 12 years was mostly breath awareness. And you know, then yeah, I did a lot of, depending on who I met and what they were into, I did a lot of Mahasi style noting. Got really into that for a while. I really didn't like the body scan, which is a big part of MBSR. I was really not a fan of the body scan until much, much, much later. Like it took me probably 10 years to kind of enjoy or appreciate the body scan. I would say this is like a very rough overview of my entire life. You know, you're asking for me to remember like decades of time. There was definitely kind of a breakthrough that I had at one point, which I think a lot of people have, which is, you know, the breakthrough between, like, they say that the wings of the Dharma, like, they fly on, you know, wisdom and compassion. And I think that there can be a tendency for certain types of people to be kind of wisdom junkies and not, and you kind of end up flying like with one wing. So I kind of had that experience where I was like, so much of my practice was so heavily weighted towards like insight. And there wasn't a lot of like heart qualities. There wasn't a lot of joy. There wasn't a lot of compassion. There wasn't like any kind of like juice, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think there was a long period of time where I kind of switched over to more heart practices. And I think around the same time, I started getting more interested in, you know, Tibetan practices and practices that have practices and traditions that have more of a life affirming kind of orientation than the sort of life denying version of Buddhism. Like there's a lot of versions of Buddhism. And one of them is like, life is a curse. And the entire point of getting the entire point of being here as a human is to like not be reborn. That was the tradition that I was, you know, my kind of my default ascent, you know, tradition. And I think that after a while I was thinking maybe like that wasn't a great fit for me, that maybe that there were other ones. And also the, you know, the tradition that I was trained in was more like, you know, there is no ground. Like if you try to find ground, then you're just a, you know, you're just a, you're just a Hindu trying to find, you know, pretending to be a Buddhist. But there are other versions of Buddhism where, you know, there is a ground and that is your true nature. And there is a place to land and there is something to kind of take refuge in. And I think that that's a little bit more, I don't know, a little softer landing. So I ended up kind of migrating, you know, again, this is like a 30-year trajectory. So.
Yeah. Oh, very interesting. And I can actually see many similarities with my own history also with meditation. And you mentioned about these traditions that are mostly about this kind of, I would call those like a pure, you know, pure world where you kind of get rid of these things that are not considered as pure, like these tantric practices where you are actually more involved in what is happening in your kind of ordinary life and experience. Yeah, so you have quite long history with meditation, and what was the reason that you kind of turned your research into these adverse effects of meditation? Does that history come from your experiences from practicing these traditions or some other researches?
I mean, I think that has a couple different tributaries. The contributors, you know, the first sort of indication that there was something worth pursuing or studying was actually my dissertation study. So up until that point, I started meditating in 1995. I went to graduate school in 2000. I did my first study ever on the neural correlates of near-death experiences. And then I went into studying meditation and did a randomized clinical trial looking at how meditation, in this case, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, so MBCT training, affected sleep as measured by brainwaves. And at that point, you know, 5 years into my practice, I was like in what they call the bright faith phase, where, you know, kind of an evangelist of like pretty all promotional, and, you know, hypothesized that meditation was going to improve sleep and that would be the way that it would improve depression, because sleep and depression are quite linked. And spent hundreds of nights watching people sleep, because it's a sleep lab. And when I got all the data in, we basically found the complete opposite of what we hypothesized, and that the meditation group, no matter how you measured the sleep, whether you're looking at, you know, the amount of fast wave activity, the amount of slow wave activity, the number of awakenings, the number of micro arousals, the meditation group's brains were more awake, more aroused. And there was a direct, you know, correlation between how much they were practicing. So it was very much kind of hard to get around that that's what we found. But I was still like kind of in denial about it. And so I didn't publish it. And I mean, I eventually did, but for a while I sat on the data thinking this is not going to like help, you know, promote this practice. And at the time I was at a meditation retreat, and I sort of mentioned to the teacher that what my data said, and she said, you know, oh, I don't know why all you clinical psychologists are trying to make meditation into a relaxation technique. You know, everyone knows if you meditate enough, you stop sleeping. So I thought, that's a little shocking. And so that led me to two other questions, which is one, you know, what other assumptions are we making as, you know, healthcare providers who are trained in like more clinical Western medicine? And we haven't really done our homework in terms of like history about Buddhism or how it's been translated into the West, like really hadn't done a lot of that work. So that was one piece. And then the other piece was clearly meditation teachers, especially ones who have been, you know, around for decades running retreat centers, have a lot of knowledge that like we haven't, that they're not telling us, and that they need to, you know, that researchers would be good to just ask them like what kinds of things have you seen. And that's basically became the, you know, the beginning of the varieties of contemplative experience study, was just simply to ask meditation teachers, you know, what types of things have you seen, how do you interpret them, and what do you do about it. There was one other event that happened. So after I finished my dissertation study, I did my residency at Brown University Medical School, and the residency is in a inpatient psychiatric hospital. That's where the department is. And so during that 1 year, there were two meditators who came off 10-day retreats and were psychotic and like put in the hospital. And so I went back to the same teacher who's fairly local and said, oh, have you ever seen that before? And it was very clear that this was also a very well-known phenomenon. And so I thought, you know, 10 years into my practice, how do I not know about this? And I'm also a meditation researcher. Like, how are we, you know, where we've been going around saying there are no adverse effects, this is much safer than, you know, medications. And yet we haven't really been asking the right questions. And so that literally that conversation was like practically the first interview was like, okay, like, so people end up in the hospital after retreats, like, fairly commonly, like, what do you want to tell us about that? So that was literally like the first interview.
Yeah, I started my kind of a formal practice in Zen community, and I remember when teachers were saying that if there are some kind of unwanted effects, it's just the makio, it's a kind of a bad phenomena, you just ignore it and go on. And I think that in many cases, when something not so good was happening with the practitioners, it was just kind of the idea that it's just a makio, it's something that the ego is doing so that you can't go on with your practices, and you just you know, be persistent and ignore these makios, and the practice will take care of these effects eventually. But I remember that in that community there was a crisis. I think I was involved in something like 8 years there. And there was this crisis then, which concerned some psychotic episodes coming from the retreats and how those were not handled properly by the teachers or the community as a whole. So it was kind of an awakening for me also about this, the other side of this meditation. And at that time, I didn't really think about so much that is it kind of a caused by meditation practices. I was more concerned of this kind of a social phenomenon where the tradition is put so much value that the people who might be suffering in those traditions are not kind of heard properly, and they are kind of if not blamed from their own problems, at least it's not properly discussed and have this kind of a conversation and finding out what is really happening and how we could actually improve these practices or how we handle these cases. So. Yeah, so I think that there's some similarities of what you were also saying. So when did you start the research then about these adverse effects?
I think we started in 2007. And it took us about 10 years to interview about 100 people. We interviewed both teachers and teachers who talked about their students and what they'd observed as teachers. And then we also interviewed 60 people who had themselves had a negative experience or a challenging experience. And 60% of those people who had had their own experience ended up being teachers. So there was a lot of representation by teachers and clinicians as well.
What's behind that? What do you think? So much of those people coming teachers themselves.
Well, that sort of links up to a very interesting question about risk factors. And so I think that, you know, when we interviewed the teachers, you know, I think all hypothesized that the people who developed, you know, meditation related adverse effects were, you know, maybe some of the, you know, quote unquote vulnerable people who had, you know, a history of trauma, a history of psychiatric issues, you know, various weak, you know, psychological weaknesses. But when we got the data back and we looked at the sample characteristics, three quarters of the sample had, you know, graduate degrees, MDs, JDs, PhDs, and some were like CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, and 60% were meditation teachers. And so it was not exactly the profile of like the most vulnerable.
Yes.
It was like really high achieving people. And so that took us a while to kind of figure out like what the link was. And the link is that these are people that are highly attuned to what external standards are. And are very good at, you know, and this is also, by the way, a kind of a trauma response as well. Mm. So there might be overlap with that kind of thing. But, you know, just knowing, like, being able to read a classroom and a teacher and be like, okay, like, this is the right answer. This is what, you know, this is how you do it. Whenever there's a task, like, you do it 150%. You know, you follow rules, you don't deviate, you don't make your own way. And that has a lot of, you know, it got people, all of these people, really far in life. And it's a very good, you know, way to be. They're highly conscientious is maybe another way to put it. But it's also a risk factor for meditation-related problems and other problems. Because if you basically, if you're kind of locus of control or your orientation is other people's standards and other people's values, then you end up meeting all of those values and not having a very strong internal compass of like what your own values are, what your own needs are. These people are very good at putting their own needs, you know, at dismissing their own needs. Like they don't know when they're hungry. They don't know, like, you know, when they need to stop. And so, and they don't, you know, they're not the kind of people that would ever modify their practice to meet their own needs, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So these are all kinds of things that, yeah. So I think that, and then becoming a meditation teacher is like, you know, it's a sign of status that you have followed your tradition, that you're able to kind of toe the party line and not cause trouble and not, you know, not deviate from what's expected of you. So yeah. That, you know, that is part of it. And that, you know, then they're ambitious. They're ambitious in their practice. Lazy people who can't seem to meditate, you know, can't seem to get to the cushion, like they don't become meditation teachers.
Yeah, so you mentioned that this people who pay attention to other people's standards and try to achieve those. And that's a little contradictory to if we think about what these traditions usually are supposed to kind of go towards, you know, the freedom, in a sense, from, you know, like the other people's standards or egoistic achievements, goals, and all that. But what you were saying, it kind of brought up this other side that perhaps what is kind of said and what is actually happening are two different things.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a chapter that I wrote in the Handbook of the Oxford Handbook of Meditation with my team about, it's a long chapter and does a lot of things, but one of the main points is that, you know, despite how they're marketed, religions are not person-centered. And what that means is that even though, you know, a meditation program might market itself as like, here, come do this thing. We're going to give you this tool to like achieve what you want to do in life. And like, it's going to, you know, it's a tool for you to do what you want. Actually, like all the goals and values are already preset. You don't get to decide what they are. You know, like you don't get to go like into a Buddhist, you know, training and sit there and, you know, look into your mind and discover that like the true, you know, the true nature of being alive is to, I don't know, make a lot of money or something, you know, like, no, that's the wrong answer. You get, you know, try again, we'll get another, you know? So, and I've actually seen, you know, I've seen that exact example play out where that was the person's answer and they were told to go back and sit more. So, you know, you're not actually free to, you know, to make, and this is not, I would not say universally true of all programs and anymore. I think things have become more person-centered, but in general, like most places that would be considered, you know, would associate themselves with the word Dharma, there are certain kinds of ideas that are not really open for interpretation. And I think that that's one of the confusing parts about people who are just like, I just want to feel better. I just want to, like, you know, be able to be less anxious and less stressed and oh, you have a tool for me, great, I'll do it. And they're not really asking about like, well, what's all the hidden curriculum behind that? What's all the, you know, what are all these hidden ideas that I'm actually like, I'm consenting to kind of start imbibing into my system, because they're part of the instructions of meditation itself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just the instruction of noticing the changing sensations of the breath, you know, noticing a thought arise and pass away. If you hear the word arise and pass away, like you are getting trained in noticing impermanence. Like that is what that is about. And like as a mindfulness teacher, which, you know, we are told that it's a secular program and we're told that it's not religious, we use words like arising and passing away, you know, which is directly, you know, teaching people the truth of impermanence, which is, you know, a straight up, you know, Buddhist idea. So, which is fine. There's no problem with teaching people that. I just think that people should know that that's what is happening. And I don't often think that that's completely transparent.
Yeah, I agree. And there are lots of kind of normative things happening in the group, so you have to adapt and, like you were saying, understand what are these social rules some of those are transparent, but others are not. And perhaps some socially skilled people can kind of intuit also these rules that are not so transparent there. And also this thing that you mentioned about this, that we might have in these traditions preset goals and preset right answers to those goals. It's like a teleological approach. You are not creating the path. It's already been created by somebody else, and you just have to find the, exactly the same path in some traditions at least. And one thing that I was already thinking back then, I think it was something like 2010 when this crisis in that group was happening, was this identity. What kind of identities people are building in the traditions? And I was thinking then, and I'm also thinking today also, that how much this identity might affect to these adverse effects. Because I believe that the meditation practices itself can do things also, but also this identity that we are building, which might be quite, normative, and it might be quite suffocating also in some senses.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of idealism there, and you have to kind of put down your own needs in some cases. And there's lots of structures that you are not aware of. And this is something that I've been also thinking about in these adverse effects of meditation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that can play out in a lot of different kinds of ways. I'll just say that in general, I've seen the pattern of a lot of meditation-related problems are in some ways like the perfect storm between the meditator's constitution and whatever tradition or practice they're engaging in. So there's not necessarily like something wrong with either one, but sometimes the combination is just like a bad match. In terms of sort of what types of identities can be problematic, there's I see that going in kind of two different directions. And just for the sake of sort of simplicity, those often are gendered. But the first one is, which is I see a lot in sort of young males, is the superhero identity, which is that the practice is going to make you into a superhero, like superhuman in some way, that you're going to have, just be kind of better at everything. You're going to have, you'll be better looking, you'll be better, people will love you. And there's also often a kind of a spiritual bypassing element to it where it's like, well, I'm 22. I just graduated from college. There's a lot of pressure on me to like become someone important. I have to get a job. I have to like attract a mate. There's so much pressure. And there's so many things to do. Like, I'm just going to get enlightened so that I don't have to deal with any of that. And like, I'll just sort of skip all that and just be on the top and just win the game of life. I mean, it's very, very vague idea, but it's amazingly attractive. And a lot of the people that come to Cheetah House are parroting that kind of model. And when I ask them, like, what exactly is enlightenment? What exactly does that look like? Let's paint the picture. Like, they don't really know. They just have been pursuing it, extremely aggressively. So that's one model, the superhero model. The other model, which I would say I often see, I see it in men too, but it's more of like a, it seems to be attractive to people who have already been told that they don't matter. Which is tends to be a more marginalized groups, is the sort of surrender model where they're like, you need to just surrender your ego. You need to like any kind of advocation for yourself or your needs is just ego. And so just completely submit to this other authority. And that's how you're, you know, and any kind of resistance that you feel is just your ego trying to like gain control. That's the other one that I see leading to a lot of problems. So I don't know your thoughts about those two, but.
Yeah, those actually seem to me quite much resemble this dysfunctional family archetypes, like the hero child and the lost child.
Mm.
And I can remember, perhaps I was a little bit of a samurai attitude meditator myself also in those younger years. And I remember these young males coming there with this samurai attitude, you know, going through the hard rock and, you know, doing anything to get enlightened or whatever was it. And I can also recognize this other side of trying to somehow become almost invisible in the world, and somehow related that to this idea of emptiness.
Yep. I mean, that was definitely my trajectory. I mean, I don't know how common this is, but you find out that the entire way that you're engaging with meditation and all of the teachers that you pick, you're just like replaying all of your family dynamics. Is that universal? I don't know. But it was definitely a theme for me. And, you know, when I was a kid, that was my role. My parents, my nickname as a kid was Wantless Needless. Like I was like a very high achieving kid. I was on like all varsity sports. I did, you know, I did straight A's. And I was always really horrified by my brother, who had lots of desires and needs and like long Christmas list. And I would never have that, you know, now I kind of see that my method of my strategy for surviving in that family and that sort of was that I'm going to earn my existence. I'm going to earn my membership in this family and my belonging by, you know, doing my part, but also not asking for anything, being invisible basically. And just trying to like be a good team member and contribute to the team, but not, you know, not ask for anything. And if that's that, by the way, that's very gendered, you know, to be this sort of invisible helper kind of person. And so, it's very easy to replicate that. And I think a lot of spiritual communities are just like, you know, built to encourage that. And it also, you know, can be a very fertile ground for some seriously problematic power dynamics and abuse.
Yeah, this reminds me of this Finnish Moomin tale, where there's these archetypal characters. One is this invisible ninny, a young girl who is literally invisible, and they try to make her visible by you know, addressing her needs and giving support and love, and little by little she becomes visible. That's fair. But there's one other archetype that I was thinking about, which is the scapegoat in these functional families. Now I was thinking about, are these the people who are not doing the practices right and perhaps are having then some problems, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important piece of this whole phenomenon, this whole syndrome, is that, you know, what happens when people report that they're having problems? Like, what's the next thing that happens? And, you know, the first thing that happens is that they're told that it's not a problem. So there's like kind of gaslighting happening that like their perception is wrong and they need to like, you know, dismiss their own sort of internal compass and go with the authority that says this is in fact not a problem. Go back and sit, which is sometimes a learning experience. But, you know, if that's the only answer you get, that's, you know, another thing. And then, you know, if they keep coming back and saying, well, actually, like, I've done what you told me, I've been doing more practice, and it's getting worse. And I really can't, in there, you're starting to interfere with my sleep, and I can't function, you know, whatever. Then there's a whole array of very predictable victim blaming that goes on. You know, there was a one young man that came to me. This exact scenario played out on a retreat that he was on, and he kept going back to the teacher and saying, like, you know, what you're telling me is not working. This is like becoming more and more problematic. And the teacher just kind of finally just said, have you ever drank alcohol ever in your life? Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, and he was actually had been sober for the last year or so. And he was like, yeah, I mean, when I was in college, I drank alcohol. And the teacher was like, well, this is like, you've brought this problem, this meditation problem on yourself from drinking alcohol like 20 years ago. And this is your fault and you need to leave the retreat right now. So, I mean, that's a very extreme example of victim blaming, but, you know, but there's often this move towards the problem is in the meditator. They've done something wrong there. There's some kind of internal deficiency, psychiatric and trauma history, pre-existing condition. They're not meditating correctly. They don't have, you know, a variety of different ways of doing that. And so, you know, the problem with that, I mean, in addition to the like fact that it's not very kind or compassionate, is that now the person has the primary symptoms that they had from the meditation, and now they have been abandoned by their teachers and their communities, and they feel what is called betrayal trauma. So they basically now feel betrayed by the place where they had previously become a refuge. That place that's becoming a refuge is now a source of harm. And that dynamic itself, which is also disorganized attachment, is extremely dysregulating to the nervous system because you have this sort of this refuge seeking impulse, which is sort of the approach impulse. And then the recoiling from the harm or the aggression and the sort of running a fight or flight response happening at the same time in response to the same person or the same place, which is the same kind of dynamic that happens when you have, you know, a parent or a caregiver who's, you know, has a drug problem or a mental illness where they're sometimes really caring and loving and sometimes really scary. Yeah. So that can, and we know from, you know, people, from kids who grow up in those kinds of childhoods, that really does a job on the nervous system. And so a lot of the meditators that come to see me have a lot of those kinds of symptoms, like their nervous systems are just super dysregulated.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are lots of things that come to my mind from that. For example, this kind of a double bind, you have basically been told that we are caring about you, we are kind of trying to help you, and at the same time there's this kind of blaming happening. Many times there can be kind of well, this reminds me of one thing that happened also in that community that I mentioned before. There was this one person who was kind of supporting and trying to help these people who had some meditation related problems, he was questioning basically the practice, like what you were also saying. If I have adverse effects, I'm kind of questioning, is this practice good for me or not? Mm-hmm. That person was questioning the practice also, and this, ways of working there. And he became very much the scapegoat. It was quite a traumatic thing for him also, even though he didn't have any meditation-related adverse effects itself. But this kind of this skillful means that I'm kind of behaving badly towards you, but actually this is just upaya or skillful means where I'm trying to help you, kind of get rid of your ego or something like that.
So, yeah, that reminds me of something that I've come to call the snakeskin principle. And the snakeskin principle is like if you put your hand on a snake and like go from head to tail, it's very smooth. And so like as long as you're going along with the party line, the practice is good. It's perfect, basically. There are no flaws. It cannot be questioned. As long as you're kind of doing, doing what you're told, everything goes well and you're loved, but as soon as you start questioning, the teacher, the Dharma, the practice as not being perfect, it's like running your hand the opposite way on the snake, and suddenly things get really sharp and are not smooth anymore. And so that principle is actually, I think, a very good litmus test for when people are asking about, well, I still want to be part of a community. I still want to meditate. Like, how do I make sure that I'm in how do I test whether it's a safe community? Start asking critical questions and see what happens.
You have to be very brave.
You get shut down right away. Like, that's not a good sign. But if people are like, yeah, okay, sure. Like, yeah, that practice isn't good for everyone. You have to make it your own. There are teachers like that, and there are traditions like that that say like that make room for individual differences and are also like mature in their spirituality, and that like things are not perfect and that sometimes there needs to be modifications. So that, I think that's a good sign.
Yeah, and you have to be quite brave to ask these critical questions. No. Now I'm thinking about this person-centered approach. You already mentioned a little bit of that. My own experience was also that I've been training meditators and also mindfulness teachers for something like 10 to 15 years. And I tried to develop a way of doing that so that you can go with the existing strengths of the people and find the goals that you are actually you want to have yourself, and not these kind of pre-made goals and practices. And I use this approach, strength-based approach that takes some elements from the family, systemic family therapy traditions, and in Finland, there's this open dialogue method that's researched in the Northern Finland, quite famously effective method. And when I saw your person-centered approach somewhere in the internet, I was thinking about how much it resembles what I'm also been doing. That instead of just trying to squeeze people in the boxes that are pre-made somewhere, why not start from the people and what works for them and develop from there? So where did you come up with this person-centered approach?
I didn't come up with it. I think that the first exposure to it was in graduate school. I took a class in motivational interviewing, which is, kind of emblematic of what the person-centered approach is. And for anyone who's listening to this and they want to understand, there's many books by William Miller and Stephen Rolnick, who invented this kind of approach. And there's ones that are for clinicians and there's ones that are for, you know, lay people. So I highly recommend following them. So that class I actually took twice because I thought it was so great. And I think part of it was, this is clinical psychology graduate school, and we're getting trained in a lot of different kinds of approaches. And one of the other approaches that I was trained in was strategic therapy. And that was more of the idea that, you know, you don't really tell the client what you're doing. And there's a lot of like, well, I'm the expert and I'm going to tell you to do all these things that are like counterintuitive to maybe your own ideas, but like you're going to do them anyway. And that just, it just didn't feel right to me. It just felt really, really uncomfortable to do it that way. And then when I took the motivational interviewing, and it was much more about like really, truly respecting other people's expertise and authority and agency, and just to see the data of how well it works. Like there's a lot of empirical data to suggest that actually empowering people to make their own decisions works better. And so, yeah, so that was the place that it all started. And I think I just recognize that as being like the way that I wanted to operate. And then, you know, fast forward throughout all of my training in, you know, various groups, meditation groups, on a long continuum of, you know, secular to Buddhist, and then working with meditators in distress, a lot of these meditators would meet criteria for, you know, religious trauma. And even if they wouldn't call it that, they are like deeply terrorized by certain kinds of ideological ideas. And so, you know, part of the rehabilitation process is like helping them learn, maybe for the first time, or helping them regain that connection with their own internal compass, and learning like when they are kind of selling themselves out for the group membership or the people pleasing, like what kind of role is that playing, and just seeing that pattern unfold. And but yeah, it seems like the most appropriate, like the most empirically supported and the most ethical approach to people with religious trauma.
And at the same time, I've heard many times these kind of words that, especially in this kind of a meditation communities, that you should not let yourself be the guide for the meditation, because you are not the teacher who knows the practices and the effects. So how have people been receiving this kind of person-centered approach in your experience?
In my experience, they have been absolutely hungering for it for a long time and not really understanding that, like, why they're so frustrated with what they've been getting. You know, and I think that when you sort of point out that like, oh, this was never person-centered, this was never there to support you in your life. Like, that's not what this is. This is for you. This typically the program is to like make you into, you know, an agent of the Dharma and like, and do, you know, operate and have specific goals of other that are already preset. When you actually introduce the possibility that like maybe you can create some of your own goals and then go and then decide from there what practice might be the best choice in order to create the goals that you choose, people are really into that idea.
Hmm.
I found, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any kind of research studies or clinical experiences that are kind of supporting this kind of person-centered approach against, let's say, teacher-centered approaches?
I mean, most of the data is, you know, within motivational interviewing is, you know, you look up on Google Scholar that the motivational interviewing data. I mean, I think so maybe not so much in meditation. I know that, you know, we do have one study where we looked at, the effects of the teacher, like the bond between the teacher and the student. And this wasn't necessarily like how well the teacher was, you know, emanating enlightened qualities or directing the student, but more like how much did they share the same goals? How understood did the client feel? How warm and empathic was the teacher? That's like sort of teacher qualities. And then there was also a relationship with the other meditators in the group.
Yes.
And then compare that to how much they meditated and what practice they were doing. So this was all part of a dismantling trial where we were comparing the influence of practice-specific effects. So like whether concentration practice versus insight practice versus the combination. It was a three-arm trial. And then we wanted to look at other factors to see what was predicting the best outcomes. And we actually found that the relationship with the group, so the other people in the group, was a bigger predictor than the qualities of the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those things were much more powerful in determining outcome than what type of meditation the person did and how much they did. So, you know, that's the other thing that, like, I think is, if you know psychotherapy research, like, such an obvious thing to ask about. You know, we're always thinking like, well, mindfulness training, you know, mindfulness, we call it mindfulness, like, or meditation has so much empirical data behind it. And it's shown to be effective. And that's how we talk, that we use the word meditation and mindfulness as the treatment. But like, what's actually happening in that treatment is that people are interacting with each other.
Mm.
We forget about that part. We're like, no, they're meditating all the time. But actually half the time they're actually talking to each other and sharing each other and having emotional relationships. And actually that's the part that is, you know, at least within a, you know, a clinical trial setting, that's predicting the outcomes, whether people get better or not. So I think that's, you know, a piece that we need to pay more attention to, that it might not actually be the practice so much. That I don't know if that answered your question, but there's another paper that also kind of reminds me of the importance of sort of choice and autonomy. In that, this is by Norman Farb, and he looked at the choice of anchor. So he gave people, I think it was the breath as a meditation anchor. I think there was a mantra choice, and there was a third choice. There's a number of choices, and so people ranked like, here are my sort of preferred anchors versus non-preferred, and then they did them. And so then, and then they looked at like, what is it, the choice of anchor, like is it the anchor that matters? So is it the practice that you're given that matters, or is it the fact that you got to choose and you got your preferred anchor? And so that, and basically the second one was what predicted the benefit. So it wasn't like the, you know, the breath was the best anchor for everybody and that's the one you should choose, which would be more of a top down, like the teacher says, kind of approach, but rather like when people are given choices, then and then they get to choose amongst those choices of what works best for them, then that was the best outcome. So I think that, you know, this is very consistent with, you know, there are basically three kind of types of approaches. One is like the directive style, where like the teacher's the expert, you do what you're told, you know, you don't know because you're not, you know, you're the unenlightened rookie and you just have to follow the directions. You know, that's kind of a militant style where it's like very hierarchical and you follow the rules and you don't have it. You're not advanced enough to have an opinion. So that's the directive style. The following style is the complete opposite, where, you know, the meditator is the authority and you just reflect back to them and help them understand themselves. And, you know, both of those have strengths and both of those have weaknesses, because obviously, like, the first one is pretty suppressing of any kind of autonomy and agency, and also is like just a fertile ground for any kind of like abusive, you know, relationship dynamics. And the second one is like, well, the person's coming to you for help. You know, like if they had all the answers inside themselves, like they would have figured it out by now. Like they might need some extra elements that they haven't thought of yet. And so the third style is kind of the combination of the directing style and the following style. And it's called the guiding style, which is kind of more like a team, or like, instead of like following you or leading you, I'm going to walk next to you. And like, because I've been on this road before, I'm going to show you all the different possible roads. I'm going to tell you what's down each one. And then you, as a client, are still going to get to decide, like, I'm going to take that road. And then, or I want to take that road. And then as the guide, I'll be like, okay, you're going to take that road. Well, let me tell you what you're going to need. You're going to need an extra pair of clothes. You're going to need a sandwich. You're going to need, you know, this is what you're going to need on that road. But I'll come with you on that road. So that's more of like what the motivational interviewing or the person-centered approach is like.
Yeah. I was just thinking about this, what we were discussing about these roles that you might have in these traditions, like this resembling the roles in a family. Especially in the dysfunctional family, you have these certain roles that you are kind of, you could almost say that the kind of the structure of the family is putting people in different roles. And it seems to happen also in meditation groups and other groups, of course, especially if there are some kind of dysfunctional elements there. It's quite easy to see that these kind of patterns start to emerge and play out in these kind of groups. And then I was thinking about this family therapy and the motivational interview. I also have been trained in that. And how much it matters in this kind of, especially family systems, that you have autonomy and agency, like you were saying. Those are very important factors in, you know, repairing the relationships and how it works, the patterns of the families. And in this open dialogue approach that is used in some psychiatric hospitals in Finland, there's one thing that it's very different from other psychiatric hospitals. It is that they don't treat the people, for example, with schizophrenia, without they be involved in the decisions that they make. And they also ask their family relatives to come there in the sessions and discuss with the patient, the relatives, the doctors, nurses, and they all decide together what is happening. Not so that some expert in some room there decides what is done to you because you are patient and you have a schizophrenia, so you don't know what to do and what you should do. But they are kind of flip that the other way around. And this, it works very well, you know, many hospitals and countries around the world are kind of studying what they are doing in those hospitals. So I think that if you don't blindly just think about meditation as a kind of a practice that is very different from other kind of things that people are doing, but we are more kind of looking at it in a social level. It's something that social groups are doing and what is emerging there. It's quite easy to see that those things that you mentioned, how your relationship with the peers in those groups is happening, what kind of alliance you have with the teacher, and those things. Of course, those things matter more than just the thing that you are doing in that so-called practice. For example, following your breathing or something like that. So what do you think?
I mean, I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, one of the first ones is just like, I'm just so curious about Finland. I'm sure have been reminded that Finland, you know, once again won the like most happy country thing. And it's just, there's a lot of attention now to like what you guys are doing right, which I think is a lot of things better than us, the US. And I want to ask you the question about, you know, what is it like to be there? And you know, what do you think? I mean, the Finns didn't invent the person-centered approach, but obviously, like, people are following their lead on certain things. I don't know if you have any thoughts about, like...
Yeah, well, if you ask any Finn about this most happiest country thing, everyone will say that, how is that possible? You know, how unhappy can other people then be if we are the happiest people? Of course, it's a little bit of a joke also. You know, it's hard to say because I've lived here all my life and I don't have very much a reference point living some other life, some other place. But I think the good thing is that in many cases, we do have these kind of structures that I was telling about in this open dialogue also, that people are getting lot of choices in the society. We don't have very much like a private schools or something that will become more elitistic, more kind of a bubbles that there are lots of rich people in some other parts of the society and poor people. There are those things also here, but perhaps not so much like that in US, for example. But I don't know. That's something that comes to my mind.
Do you think that plays out in the way that meditation is taught
in Finland?
I mean, I'll just say that I think that our entire, I'm not sure about other countries, but in the US, it seems like, you know, the capitalistic, individualistic, kind of Darwinian American way, it has also made its way into meditation. And that we all, and I noticed this, I've been teaching at Brown University for almost 20 years. And so I've also noticed this getting worse and worse and worse within the students, and just this paralyzing pressure to be special and to be awesome, to be just like over the top awesome, like the sort of competitive pressure. And So there's a way to, you know, this is kind of like the superhero, you know, thing, yeah, where like the meditation is going to make me sort of give me a competitive edge. And then there's also the other possibility, which is kind of, again, my own arc of my trajectory, which was my practice eventually kind of eroded my ambition. And that I'm, you know, just much more kind of accepting with how I am. And I'm not going to try to be awesome on every front because it's exhausting and stressful. And so, yeah, I don't know if you think that the social system of Finland is, it's different than that.
Yeah. This reminds me when we had this problem in that community I mentioned, I wrote a blog post afterwards. There had been many things happening. And then the title of that blog post in Finnish was the Meditation and the Art of Being a Scandinavian. And my point was there, I guess, that the way where these meditation groups or community was led was very much, coming from the Eastern American cultures.
Mm.
And people were not getting, they were not treated like we should be treating each other in northern countries, in the northern welfare state. And this is something that I was kind of inside of mind that, wait a minute, what is happening in that community is something that we would never allow in our northern welfare state.
Hmm.
So we are kind of, the community had took culture from a little bit militant Japanese culture and then this American culture came from also. So I think that in these meditation groups that we have in Finland, they are led mostly, they are trying to kind of resemble the culture where they are coming from. You know, Buddhist groups are, you know, Buddhist culture and yoga groups try to have some kind of perhaps Indian culture or something like that. So I don't know how many groups there are that are kind of designed by our own culture. I think that our group that we have been kind of developing during these 15 years is more like that, but it's imported mostly, I think.
And it also strikes me as kind of a paradox, and we have been paying so much attention to cultural sensitivity and, you know, medicine and psychotherapy. And we have this entire field now of, you know, cultural psychology and cultural medicine. And a lot of that was based on making sure that Western ideals were not imposed on other countries and that we needed to be much more sensitive to the way that they understand, you know, well-being and illness and the ways that those things can manifest, and to not, you know, impose our ideas of those. But what's so ironic is that, you know, within the meditation culture, you know, if we were going to apply this sort of principle that, like, you should always honor a culture's sort of native ideas, right? And that, like, when a new treatment or modality or technology comes from another place, it should always be incorporated within the culture's already established values, right? So that's the sort of principle that we're talking about. But in the case of meditation, often we've basically allowed there to be this sort of reverse imperialism where, like, now the values of the original, I clearly have never articulated this idea before because I'm struggling to articulate it, but, you know, we're basically taking on, we're not standing up for our own values within, you know, within meditation cultures, like, that we're allowing you know, those ideas to be imposed on us and not saying like, actually, we believe in individualism. Actually, we believe in like, you know, not having the teacher have all the answers and submitting to authority. And, you know, so it's interesting.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's my experience also, that especially if it's a very traditional tradition, in a sense that it tries to kind of follow the idealistic form of that tradition, it seems that people are willing to let go of the kind of their own values and culture and adapt to that one. And they will also say that, you know, you have to let go of that individualistic Western idea because it doesn't work with these practices. But then there are some other groups. I know that like in the US there is this Springwater Center that was established by late Tony Packer, where they actually tried to incorporate this kind of a Krishnamurtian style of free practice, no authorities, no hierarchies, and it's running there. So I guess there are some groups everywhere that are also trying to, you know, develop this more the practices or the kind of things that are more in line aligned with our own value systems and what works with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We are, I guess, coming to an end of this podcast, but I still want to ask you a little bit about this person-centered approach. What would you like to say people listening to this and perhaps struggling with their own practices or trying to decide whether these meditation practices would be a good fit for me or not?
Well, at the risk of doing shameless self-promotion, I did create something called My Map, which is the My Meditation Assessment Process. And it's just something that it reflects a conversation that I've had over and over and over again with people, like trying to reorient their meditation practice in a person-centered way. And it's basically just an Excel sheet. And you can get it at the Cheetah House website. It's on the online courses tab. I'm actually having a follow-up workshop today for people who fill it out. But basically the idea is you write down all the reasons why you want to meditate, like what kinds of functions you hope that it will fulfill. Like maybe it will help calm your mind. It'll give you a more comprehensive worldview of, you know, what we're doing here, life and death. Maybe it will give you a community. Maybe, you know, there's a whole bunch of reasons why people meditate. And it's really good to articulate that to ourselves, at least to know like what we wanted. And also those can change over time. And so when I first started meditating at age 20, I was really attracted to the sort of like comprehensive worldview approach. Like I didn't have a comprehensive worldview. I was 20 and I was kind of lost. And I liked that everything sort of fit together in this perfect way. And that was a very important thing for me. And you know, following Dharma teachers for 2 decades, like helped with that. But if you go through this process, like the practices that I did, you know, like I said, I was a wisdom junkie, so I kind of overtrained in a lot of the wisdom approaches. I did a lot of noting, I did a lot of concentration, and I was pretty weak on the compassion side of things and the relational side of things. And so as I'm mapping out my practice, like I needed to be updated to reflect like what I'd already done and like the strengths that I'd already built. And then also to see like, okay, what do I need to do now? And so, you know, it's kind of shocking to me that like, this isn't like a periodic thing that like should happen in everybody's approach, which is like, okay, how's it going? You know, like what was first of all, just like there should be, I think, an approach when people should clarify their values before they start. Like, what are you after? What do you want out of this? Like, what would your life look like? Like, really get into detail. Like, what would your life look like if you got what you wanted? And if that's enlightenment, like, great. Just write that down, what that's going to look like. Like, very specifically, like, what kind of emotions do you have? Are you missing emotions that you used to have? Do you have new emotions that you didn't have? Or do you have no emotions at all? Like, how many thoughts do you have? Do you have less thoughts? Do you have different thoughts? Like, you know, how does your body feel? What do you look like? Who's around you? How are they relating to you? Like, all of that, like, play it out. You know, write a little, like, do a creative writing exercise about, like, I'm enlightened now and this is what my life looks like. So you can really see, like, what kind of hopes and projections you're putting onto that idea and, like, really get it out there. And then I think once you kind of get a sense of, like, what you want, then it makes it much easier to start choosing practices that might be a better practices and teachers and systems that might be a better fit for your goals. And again, like to reiterate what I said before, a lot of the problems that I'm seeing are just simply mismatches between the person and the practice that they chose. And so many people just end up practicing whatever practice was best advertised to them. I'm like, literally, like, people are like, oh, I'm going to learn to meditate, like, go to the Apple store, press meditation, and, like, you know, you either get Calm or Headspace because they have the most money to do the advertising to get their app to the top of the list. And that's how it's decided for you what meditation you choose. That should not be the way that you choose your meditation practice. Your meditation practice is, like, you know, I would say it's up there with choosing a life partner. You know, it's kind of like an intimate thing. And so it shouldn't be market forces that are deciding what practice you do. Like, you should be a very deliberate, conscious process. And also one where, like, you should be a demanding consumer, and that, like, if it's not meeting your goals, like, trade it out for another one. I mean, I don't want to, like, create just, like, a, you know, super high demand, you know, high maintenance people that are just like, you know, I'm not enlightened after 24 hours, like, give me the next thing. Like, obviously, like, this is hard work, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of commitment on the part of the meditator too. But, you know, I've also seen people that, like, have just continued to engage in a practice that was harming them for decades.
Yeah.
And, like, just continued it to, well, at some point it's going to turn around, you know? And it's like, well, how much of your life do you want to, like, donate to that cause if you're wrong? So I think that, yeah, this other process is a way of turning it around and being like, you know, is your meditation practice serving you, or are you serving your meditation practice? And, like, these are, you know, kind of meta ethical questions about, like, those are both legitimate ways of practicing, but you know, you have to make a choice as to which one that you want to choose. And I personally am promoting, you know, the first one, that the meditation practice is a tool and it should be serving you. And then how do you engage with that? So the clarifying your goals, and then also re-clarifying your goals and whether your practice is meeting them and whether it might need to be adapted or modified. So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Vilokki, for this conversation. I have learned a lot here and gained some insights that I haven't been thinking about before. This was very much fun. Thank you.
It was fun. Thanks a lot, Ari.
Tämä oli Mielen laboratorio. Jos kärsit meditaation tai mindfulness-harjoitusten haittavaikutuksista, tsekkaa rakentamani online-kurssi osoitteesta mielenlaboratorio.thinkific.com. Kurssilla on kattava tieto meditaation haittavaikutuksista sekä ohjeita yksilöllisten harjoituspolkujen rakentamiseen. Tutustu myös kirjoihini Mielen laboratorio ja Mindfulness, mielenselkeys ja myötätunto. Jälkimmäinen löytyy nyt myös äänikirjana kaikista suosituimmista äänikirjapalveluista. Jos pidit jaksosta, suosittele sitä myös ystävillesi, jotta hekin pääsevät tutustumaan oman mielensä sokkeloihin.